A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Well, it's good to have you along. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. And we're going to move on. We've got a lot to talk about today. And we're going to kick things off talking about some of the numbers regarding out-of-wedlock births. And, man, things have changed. And the differences between the states, absolutely dramatic. We'll talk about that in a moment. We're looking forward to a conversation with the Salvation Army. Over the weekend, I saw some of the iconic kettles and the bell ringers out there, but there are other ways to give this year, in case you don't have a pocket full of change. And many people don't anymore. Heidi Matthews, who is the president of UEA, she will be joining us, and we're anticipating a special session of the legislature to talk about tax reform coming up maybe on the 12th. That's the date that I keep hearing, and we thought we'd chat with her about the funding for education. We'll also be talking with Primary Children's Hospital. We're going to be talking about a new emphasis and a new way that they are helping kids up there. Sim Gill will be joining us. Maybe you heard the conversation with Representative Ben McAdams chatting with our Boyd Matheson just a little while ago about a resolution out there to help protect kids from inappropriate material when it comes to apps in the digital world. And it was alluded in that article that there are quite a few prosecutions going on against child predators in our own area. And I thought, well, hey, let's talk with Sim Gill, our Salt Lake County District Attorney. Alex Stone, our friend and associate from ABC. How banks are data collecting now. Yeah, it's not just Google. It's not just Facebook. Apparently, it's your bank as well. And Pete Ashdown, founder of X Mission. We always turn to Pete on high-tech issues, and this digital face recognition stuff is getting to the point where it's almost creepy. We're going to talk about that. And there was an interesting article that said, boy, it's time to put the brakes on this before we can figure out what people's rights actually are. And more, you'd be surprised, apparently, according to this article, how many times we are basically being scanned and our faces, our images are being weighed against data banks. And, well, we'll talk about that with Pete. But right now, let's get to the topic of hand, just to give you a little idea of where we're going here. Utah, Idaho, and Colorado, an interesting trio. We have much in common with the demographics and religious beliefs and so on with Idaho, but not so much Colorado. But yet, we are three states that are, you know, depending, of course, on your points of view, but we have some of the lower numbers when it comes to out-of-marital situations, birth. Utah is the lowest at 19.2, Colorado 23.2, and Idaho 27. It's interesting because you can say, well, Utah and Idaho are very religious states. Maybe that explains it. Well, Colorado is not listed on many national surveys as being probably one of the 10 least religious states in the country. So what is going on? Mississippi, by the way, 54.1% of all births in Mississippi are outside of wedlock, followed by Louisiana, then New Mexico, then Nevada and Delaware. And Minnesota is at 31.9%, Washington at 31.1%. We needed some expertise on this, so we turned to Professor Spencer L. James, who is on the line with us, Associate Professor of Family Life and Africana Studies, Director of Global Family Relationships at BYU. And Professor, welcome and thank you for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Are you surprised at all by some of the statistics that I just gave, and especially with the very low, relatively speaking, very low rates that are here in Utah and Colorado and in Idaho?
I'm always interested to see statistics such as this, but I can't say that I was surprised. A lot of the explanation, I believe, has to do with the combination of both religious and relatively affluent economic well-being that we see right now in both Utah and Idaho, Utah in particular. A state like Colorado, although not quite as religious, still has some fairly traditional conservative values that often emanate from a formerly religious culture. And certainly Utah is probably our nation's best example of the effect of both a stable and prosperous economy combined with what we know is the effect of high religious activity and participation mm-hmm. on stable family relationships.
I was wondering about the socioeconomic and the economy and the income. In the article that prompted this conversation in the Deseret News, it was also on DeseretNews.com, there is a whole section that says money matters, and that's when they tend to bring up the statistics that make such a difference between Colorado and New Mexico. They talk about Colorado being a state that tends to be well-off and better educated versus New Mexico, among the states where half the births are to unwed mothers, a smaller percentage of their residents with bachelor's degree or higher than the national average, which is not the case in New Mexico, and nearly 20% of its residents live in poverty. It seems to be, when you look at those numbers, that money does matter.
Oh, absolutely. And so there are several factors that are often thought to be associated with trends in non-marital childbearing. And you mentioned a couple of them, one of the primary ones being education. So when you look at the non-marital birth rate by education level, it's almost unheard of for people with bachelor's or more levels of education to have births outside of wedlock, whereas those with less than a high school degree, it's actually normative for that to occur. And so states, all things being equal, with higher levels of education, and Colorado would certainly be on that list, are typically going to experience lower levels of non-marital childbearing. Another factor that's worth mentioning here is the delay in the age at marriage. Again, all things being equal, the later you are having children, the more likely you are to be having those children in marital relationships rather than outside of them.
As you have studied the effects, and I'd like to get into that, how it affects our society and how it affects the kids, because there are those that are arguing that this is, you know, it may not have the stigma it once did. Boy, when I was a kid, you know, out of wedlock birth certainly occurred, but boy, nobody was talking about it. Nobody was bragging about it. It was still a real social stigma with that. Does it still carry that social stigma?
I don't think it has nearly the same social stigma that it once did, and we're fortunate that most children are remarkably resilient, and so it's hard to paint with a large brush here, but there are certain trends that we can point to. One of those trends, as you mentioned, is the reduced stigma associated with non-marital births. It's simply much more common than it once was. And one of the most pronounced changes to family patterns over the past 60 or 70 years since World War II has been the advent of widespread births outside of marriage. Now, it's worth noting that most of these births are not actually to non-coupled women. Many of these births, and probably around anywhere from half to two-thirds, are actually to the women who are cohabiting with the child's father. Now, the biggest difference and one of the biggest implications between births to cohabiting individuals compared to married individuals is in how long those relationships last. Research suggests that the probability of a cohabiting relationship breaking up when you track it from the birth of their child is much, much greater, dramatically greater than the probability of a child born to married parents experiencing a parental breakup. And there's a long literature showing the deleterious effects of family instability on child well-being across a variety of health, social, emotional and educational outcomes.
We're talking with Associate Professor of Family Life and Africana Studies, Director of Global Family Relationships, Spencer L. James, with us from BYU today. With the national number hovering right around 40%, in the article, it didn't compare, you know, back in the 1950s or whatever. I don't know if you have any of those numbers in your recollection, but I mean, how dramatic an increase is this for the overall national number to be hovering around 40%?
Yeah, well, it certainly is quite a trend, certainly when you compare back to, say, the 1950s. We actually, this summer, released a report where we go over this called The State of Our Unions 2019.
Mm-hmm.
If your listeners want to simply type that into a search engine, you can pull these numbers up. Sorry, I should have had them pulled up.
No, that's okay. It's on State of Our Unions. Is that right?
Yes. It's the State of Our Unions report from just this past summer.
Okay.
Basically, the percent of non-marital births over the past 50 or 60 years has had a dramatic increase, although it does now appear to be somewhat stabilizing right around 40%. Whether it stays that way long-term, obviously, has yet to be seen. But certainly, the increase in non-marital childbearing has been one of the largest changes to American family patterns that we've observed.
It was interesting in this article, and then I really want to focus on the kids themselves that are born out of wedlock, as is the term. But I thought this was the good news. Almost all teen births are now non-marital births. That didn't used to be true in the past, but since the national campaign to prevent teen pregnancy began in the 1990s, teen pregnancy has fallen by more than 70%, and those numbers appear to still be in decline. That seems to be a real good news part of this story.
Absolutely. And that national campaign is one of the best examples that we can point to of the effectiveness of public policy and advocation. Sometimes we can get a little bit distressed about ineffective public policy and advocacy groups, but the truth is, with the right combination of people and the right amount of political will, we were able to dramatically reduce the number of teen pregnancies in the United States in a relatively short period of time. So there's absolutely reason for hope there.
Back in the old days, too, if a teen was pregnant, there was all kinds of social and usually family pressure and religious pressure put on them to, regardless, we don't care if you love each other, we don't care what the circumstances are that you are in, this child will have a name. Shotgun weddings, that was the term. That seems to be pretty much a thing of the past, too.
Yes, and I think for the most part, that's a good thing. Most of the evidence, maybe parlaying into what effect this has on the children, suggests that the best family outcomes, the best child outcomes, are most likely to be achieved when both parents are committed to their relationship and want to have a stable and happy long-term relationship. And those didn't tend to come very often from shotgun marriages.
Right. Let's just run through as a final thought for our listeners here. What are some of the liabilities? Again, back in the day, think of how many old movies were made about this, how many novels centered around this, that, boy, you know, there were rock and roll songs about this, you know, Love Child and so on. What are the liabilities? And I'll ask the question, are there any benefits?
To non-marital childbearing?
Yes.
Yes. Well, to almost everything, there are benefits and disadvantages. The primary disadvantages have a lot to do with the circumstances in which that child is born. So non-married parents, on average, don't tend to live in as good of neighborhoods. They tend to attend schools that aren't as well funded. And as I mentioned previously, parental relationships don't tend to last as long, and all of these things, among many others, have been shown to be detrimental to the probability that children are as successful as we would like them to be. Perhaps the most commonly cited benefit to non-marital childbearing Sometimes relationships are really, really bad. And sometimes marriage is not the answer. And so it may be easier to break up a relationship between the parents that is potentially abusive when it is a non-marital one than when it is a marriage. And I think in many ways that can be a good thing. I don't want to overstate that, given right. the enormous amount of evidence that marriage benefits everybody involved. But in certain circumstances, when a relationship needs to end, it could be easier to have a non-marital one, to have a cohabiting relationship rather than a marriage.
Your insights have been valuable. I really appreciate you joining us, Professor James. Thank you for spending
this time.
Very interesting. Professor Spencer L. James, Associate Professor of Family Life, Africana Studies, Director of Global Family Relationships at BYU, and as he mentioned, you can look up some of the statistics he was referring to on the state of our unions, and it was out just this past summer, and the article that prompted this conversation was in the Deseret News. You'll find it on Deseret.com as well. Let's take a break, and I'm anxious. Over the weekend, I saw the bell ringers out, and to tell you the truth, I was walking out of the store. I felt guilty. I didn't have any, you know, dollar bills. I didn't have any change in my pocket, so I just kind of slithered on by. Normally, I give. I really do. But apparently, if I had known this, I could have given anyway. We'll talk about what's up coming up next.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are. And this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Well, here we are in December now, and the talk of a special legislative session during December has been all over the place, but it appears that the date now that the special session has lighted upon is the 12th. However, even that has not been officially announced, and it may be officially announced later on this afternoon. You know, who knows? But there are just so many issues. We've talked about it here on radio. I've talked about it on our Sunday morning TV show. And what exactly is on the docket? Now, in the past, last year, you might recall that the main focus during the legislative session was going to be on sales tax. And the governor and others had promised, no, now overall, there will be a general reduction for the vast majority of Utahns. But yes, we do need to change things in light of the new economy, lack of brick and mortar business, and traditional sales tax revenue, more efficient vehicles. So the sales tax that we have brought through motor fuels is down dramatically, things like that. But as we've gone on, this is an even broader scope, I think, than had been anticipated last year at this time. And one of the things that I'm hearing is that perhaps we ought to not only reduce the income tax, which, of course, remember, bear this in mind, anytime we say income tax, all of our income tax here in the state of Utah, for those of us that pay the state income tax, it all goes to K through 12 and higher education. It's in the Constitution. It has to. And when you hear about a tax reduction on income tax, well, that means less revenue will go into the schools, right? Well, when that's brought up with our legislators, they assure us that other things that they have afoot will more than make up for that. But also what is being discussed is perhaps changing the Constitution of the great state of Utah to allow more flexibility when it comes to the general fund and the state income tax, which right now is earmarked all for education. A lot of things are still in a state of flux. A lot of this theoretically will be shaken out rather dramatically in the special session. And then, of course, as we move on, the idea is to have all this in place for the tax year 2020. So Utahns will be able to get used to and be able to plan on some of the new taxation regulations or guidelines for the year 2020. I wanted to bring Heidi Matthews on the line with us, and Heidi is the UEA president. And Heidi, I think everybody, including legislators, are nervous about what this will do for education. Already some educators are getting some heat saying, well, now, wait a minute. How is this going to work? How are we going to not have a reduction in the funding of our education system if we lower the tax rates? And will you not have to make that up elsewhere, maybe on an even much more hated tax than the sale, than the income tax, with property tax? And so I thought I'd tap into your expertise. What are you anticipating, and what are you hearing regarding the special session?
You hit the nail on the head with us having a lot of uncertainty about the direction that this tax restructure has gone, which makes it entirely premature to have a special session in days. I loved Gail Miller's article that was in the Tribune this weekend. Maybe it was even today. Yesterday. Where she talks about, you know, putting children first. It's a good place to start. And what we have been saying at the UEA is highlighted in Gail Miller's article, that the proposals that are coming from this tax restructure process are not focused on what our students need. And we know that they need smaller class sizes so that they can have individual attention. We know that they need high-quality early learning opportunities, and we know that they need classes that are guided by qualified educators that are ready to reach them on the first day. And we have plans that are in place that have been put together by very thoughtful people, the Governor's Commission, the Utah Foundation, Envision Utah, that would specifically address those needs, but they require resources, and all that we have seen so far from this tax commission is really about cutting the education fund, instilling those things that would, yes, account for growth and enrollment growth and inflation. But again, we haven't seen the specific plans. I feel like we're on a good track, but we're nowhere near the place that we need to be in order to make such a decision of this magnitude, and make sure that our students are taken care of and able to reach their potential.
I think of the old adage at this point, you know, the stock market can handle good news and bad news. It just can't handle uncertainty. And I think it's the uncertainty right now that is driving folks a little, you know, crazy on this one, and maybe underreacting in some cases and overreacting in others. You referred to Gail Miller's op-ed piece, and I thought it was interesting at the very last. She said, "For me, the bottom line is that nothing will keep our economy growing more than our investment in education. It's the right thing to do for our economy, for our businesses, and for our families. We should leave our Utah Constitution alone and invest in the long-range education plan so that many good people took so much time to develop." And she talked earlier in the article that the way things are structured right now was passed by voters in the 1930s. I mean, that was during the Depression, for specific purposes to make sure that education was always taken care of. And the thing that's so interesting for me, and honestly a little troubling for me, Heidi, I've reached out to a lot of people for whom I have a lot of respect. Some have joined us on the air. Some I've just read their comments. And boy, it's all over the place. I talked with Natalie Gochner last week, and she said, "Well, you know, we're all kind of wondering, and we're all keeping an eye on this." And at the time, I thought it was interesting because I brought up the constitutional amendment change with Natalie, and I said, "How realistic is that?" And she said, "Well, you know, it's complicated. I'm not really sure, but I hope education will continue to," her term, "stay at the table." Are you guys staying at the table?
Absolutely. This is what we do at the Utah Education Association, you know, making sure that our students have the promise of public education moving forward. We have seen a lot of progress being made in these tax restructure efforts. you know, for the first time, we're hearing our legislators talk about the importance of assuring that enrollment growth is filled every year. For the first time, we're really hearing that we should have a strong commitment to capturing inflation. But what we're not hearing is the growth of the investment in public education that is necessary to address the needs of our students and of our educators that are critical right now. It's again getting back to the time for a special session. So much of what is being discussed is based on changes to the Utah Constitution, which importantly requires a vote of the citizens.
Right.
And to make any massive changes right now on the chance that our citizens will pass those changes, I think it's just entirely premature. It needs so much more discussion and vetting and again, looking to the bottom line of how it's going to impact our students in Utah, which again has not been necessarily the focus throughout this process.
Heidi, I don't want to overly tax your time here, no pun intended. Could you stay with us for a second more? There are a couple of issues I'd like to flesh out a little bit more.
You bet.
I'd like to talk about the constitutional amendment, and that to me at least, and maybe I'm just a dolt and didn't catch it last year, but it was all about sales tax last year, and it was all about lowering the overall taxes that Utahns would pay and so on, but everything seemed to be focused on the sales tax. And now there are some other focuses, and one thing that I also wanted to get into, and I mentioned that I've reached out or have read things from people that I have some admiration for. And on Utah Policy, LeVar Webb, who is the publisher, I've known LeVar for years, and I always appreciate his viewpoint. He laid out some of his thoughts on tax reform, and there was one whole section, tax reform will not hurt education, and that was under the category. He was kind of going through some of the main concerns that people are bringing up, and one is that the reform would hurt education. His argument is that it won't. When we come back, maybe I can get some of your thoughts on that as well. All here at KSL News Radio, we're talking with the president of the Utah Education Association, Heidi Matthews. She'll be staying with us for one more segment. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you on our Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line at 57500. Well, it's good to have you along on the program today. And again, our text line, if you have any questions or comments as our conversations continue, we'd love to hear from you on the Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line at 57500. Heidi Matthews is joining us. And, you know, Heidi, you referred to something that both you and I were involved in, and that was Envision Utah's effort to figure out what it would really take to, it was called kind of the teacher compensation, but what it would really take to make the profession what it needs to be, to make it something that people would aspire to more than they do now, even going back earlier and recruiting earlier and providing scholarships. And then once people do, you know, end up in the classrooms, making it a much more desirable place to stay. We have such a dramatic, startling turnover by the time teachers hit that five-year mark. And you and I were involved in all of the conversations on that. And I remember talking about the compensations. I don't remember anywhere, and maybe I'm adult. Maybe I missed something. And I was at every meeting. I was at every meeting save one where I sent my wife, who works in education, to be my proxy. And I don't remember a real big conversation going on about changing the Constitution of the state of Utah to basically do away with the earmark for education on income tax. Did I miss something?
Well, if you did, I did as well. Because what I felt about being a part of the Envision Utah's task force on teacher compensation, as well as being a part of the governor's excellence and Education Commission is that these are visionary groups that are looking at the looking to the future and what is it going to take for us to have the schools that we need to have for our students and in our state in Utah. And this visionary look is not simply just what can we do to get by. You asked the question, you know, would tax restructure hurt our students? I say our students are hurting right now. We have some of the largest class sizes in the nation. We have impacts of poverty and mental health issues that are more and more being addressed in schools. We have teachers, as you said, who are leaving the classroom in just dramatic, we call it a teacher exodus mm-hmm. out of the classroom because they simply can't make this work as a career given all the pressures that they have on them. And that is going to require, it's going to require investment, and it's going to require this more visionary look at where we're going with our school and getting them where we're going with our schools and getting our schools and education system the resources that we need. And if we continue to just say that what we're doing right now is fine, that will continue the harm for our students.
I mentioned LeVar Webb's comments, the piece that he wrote for Utah Policy, and he is the publisher. And when it got to the education part, he said, quote, "The tax reform plans," plural there, notice that, "combined with the education funding proposal will improve education funding for the long term." This is the term that we're hearing. They're not saying constitutional amendment. They're saying education funding proposal. And then as we get down here, the constitutional education earmark is a fragile funding guarantee. Much better would be a permanent commitment to automatically fund growth and inflation in education, putting in place a system for additional funding increases, including by requiring, and boy, this caught my attention, a larger local contribution to education funding. What are we talking about there? You know, would it be a property tax?
Well, the property tax, more of a local investment, has definitely been a part of what is being discussed. But, you know, his point about having a stronger constitutional language that would ensure that growth and inflation and enough resources to really move the needle in these areas that require significant investments, I'm in absolute agreement.
Sure.
That is what we want to continue to work toward, no matter how it looks. But I think that the difficulty is that those plans are not, they're not public. They're not vetted. They're not written into bill language. They're not being examined and discussed and looked at their impacts that they're going to ultimately have on each and every student sitting in our Utah classrooms. And until we can have those conversations and have that information and that reassurance, it's entirely premature to pass an overhaul tax change that is predicated upon those kind of unknown plans.
In this article, again, that LeVar authored, he says, House Speaker Brad Wilson notes that Utah is fifth highest in the nation in the proportion of education funding provided by the state, but Utah is 33rd in local district contributions. LeVar seems to be focused on the additional funding opportunities or burdens that would be out there within the local communities. And, you know, I try to imagine that for our little school district of Tintic. And I think, and we are not the smallest school district. I think the smallest school district is in Paiute County. You would know better than I. But I try to imagine how in our little local community out there that goes all the way to the Nevada border, by the way, out to, you know, our little, you know, West Desert school.
Daggett. Yeah. Daggett's the smallest.
Daggett is the smallest. Okay. But I'm trying to imagine how Daggett, how Paiute, how Eureka, the Tintic School District, how are we going to put more giving opportunities on the local contributions out there. I'm flummoxed by that.
Well, and I think that again speaks to the very core of our conversations right now, is that these details are only hinted at. They are not specifically laid out for people to consider. Property taxes is inherently the most inequitable form of taxation. We have districts that are, all over the place in terms of how much federal land that they have, or, you know, what their taxable valuation is within their district boundaries. From what I understand, the conversations about this aspect of it do include a piece that the state would take care of some equity funding. But again, we haven't seen it. We haven't had a chance to really explore what that would look like. And then the other part that I think is important to recognize is with the comparison of state effort versus local effort. Yes, we do have a greater state effort for public education than a local effort, as compared to many other states. But when you're talking about actual dollars, it really is out of proportion there too. Given that we are the lowest funded per pupil in the nation, it places a little bit of a different emphasis on who is carrying more of the tax burden.
Right. There are obviously so many questions to be answered here. I'm anxious to look forward. I've had the chance to talk with Lyle Hilliard. I've had the chance to talk with Francis Gibson. I've had the chance to talk with Speaker Wilson. I've had the chance to talk with the governor. I've had the chance to talk with you and on our Envision Utah panel. Boy, we had some very interesting and very bright people in education, in business, outside of business, everything else. On that, and I'm very anxious to see what this finally looks like. But the bottom line that I've heard, at least in our Envision Utah quest, and you have been in others, is that, yeah, we not only need to maintain and keep the status quo of where we are, we need to dramatically add to it to improve the conditions, first and foremost for our students. Second of all, for our great teachers, to keep them in the profession. I didn't hear one person, not one even veiled comment that, well, we really ought to be spending less. I have not heard that anywhere from anybody.
Nor have I, which again, Love Gail Miller's article, where she's just really calling that out, that people are not saying that we should be spending less. We have these great plans that have been put together by thoughtful people, and yet the discussion in the tax restructure has been about flexibility and ratios and things, not what's best for kids. And that's, again, what we at the Utah Education Association just really keep coming back to, is that bottom line of how our students are going to be impacted. And when they have teachers who are leaving, you know, half of the teachers are leaving in their first 5 years, only to be replaced with people who are good-hearted but learning on the job, that's not good for our students. And we need a significant investment in public education well beyond funding enrollment growth and inflation. And that is what has not been included in the proposals that we've seen. And that's why it makes it that a special session in the next weeks is entirely premature for this discussion to continue. We need to know that those assurances that we will be growing that investment in public education are in place, and that any discussion of a constitutional change that is embraced by all, including the vote of the people, before you make any decision that is contingent upon those ongoing plans.
Heidi, as always, I appreciate your participation. Thank you for joining us. We're going to keep a very, very close eye on this.
Thank you.
So many fine and decent people are working on this. I just hope we get it right.
And we're on. It's going to be a long game. You know that.
Yeah.
This is a long-term discussion, but our short game right now is to not be too hasty with this special session. Give us time to work out what's going to work out for everyone in our state of Utah, but particularly our students.
Heidi, I'll look forward to seeing what bubbles up in the next couple of weeks. We'll stay in touch, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Heidi Matthews with us, the president of the UEA, Utah Education Association. I dragged us a little past our time for news. We'll take a break. We'll come right back. Afterward, we'll be talking with the administrator for Intermountain Primary Children's Hospital. We'll talk about something very cool that's happening up there. Stay with us.
Afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
You know, for as long as I can remember, and that's a considerable amount of time now here at KSL, there has been a special bond and a special relationship between Primary Children's Hospital and KSL News Radio. And anything that I read regarding Primary Children's always has a special meaning for me. And when I saw this, that there is the launch of Primary Children's Center for Personalized Medicine, it ushers in a new era for medicine and wellness for children throughout the Intermountain West. I wanted to know more, and I really appreciate the administrator of Intermountain Primary Children's Hospital joining us, Dustin Lipson, who is on the line. Welcome. Thank you for taking time to join us here at KSL.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Well, I'm anxious to learn more about this. Rather than me bloviate here, tell us what this is and what it's going to do.
Yeah, so this center introduces a lot of genomic-based technologies into clinical care at Primary Children's Hospital. So maybe it's easier to understand that in the context of an example. In July, we introduced what we call rapid whole genome sequencing into our a neonatal intensive care unit. So we sequence the entire genome of a child to more quickly diagnose what's wrong with them and to treat them faster.
So tell me, this is obviously way out of my league. So what does it do? What does it tell you? Where is this stored? Who has access to it? What difference can it make?
Yeah, so there are roughly 7,000 genetic diseases that affect children. And today we can treat probably about 30 of those diseases. The idea is that this genetic information, which is held, you know, deep inside your body's cells, we're not treating a broken bone or your blood or, you know, your eyes. We're treating something very deep within the body. And the way that we do that is we're able to take blood, and now we can understand at a very detailed level how you're built. And we take that information, and we can use certain therapies or drugs to change those basic building blocks.
By reading the human genome, then, what can you see and what can you predict? And if Joe Average actually saw all this information about him or herself, would it scare us to death?
No, I don't think it would scare us. I think what it does is it enables us to become healthy, and in fact, we're able to give families answers that they've never had before. Frankly, it's one of the most exciting aspects of the program is if you have a very sick child, we've gone for years with certain types of illnesses where we couldn't tell you really what was wrong, and these new technologies provide those answers. Not only do they provide the answers, but in some cases, they provide treatment. So we have new treatments aimed directly at genetic diseases. So for example, you may have heard of spinal muscular atrophy. It's called SMA. It's the number one genetic killer of kids. There are now a drug out, which we were one of the first six centers in the country to introduce, where that drug actually affects the genes themselves and stops the progression of this disease. And so you can go from previously, a decade ago, a death sentence to now living what is a remarkable, healthy life.
That is so incredible to think of what can be done. And as you look at this even futuristically, I was somewhat taken with that number you gave. There are more than 7,000 known genetic diseases, And did I hear you say that we can basically, now we're dealing with about 30 of them? What kind of a door will this open then?
Well, we hope it's a really big door, and we feel very blessed to have the resources at the University of Utah Health and Intermountain Precision Genomics and Primary Children's. This really is a Utah partnership to discover new treatments for a lot of these diseases. And that's what makes it one of the most exciting announcements that I've been able to be a part of.
You mentioned SMA, number one killer of kids. And you mentioned actually going in and dealing with the genes themselves. Do you just kind of turn them off or remove them? What do you do? I'm adult on this stuff.
Yeah, so I like to explain this using an analogy. So genes are like, imagine if you had a cookbook. And, you know, each page is a recipe, and those recipes are basically your genes. And in this case, you could go into your recipe book, and over time, you know, well, hey, there was a misprint in this book, and this ingredient's not the right ingredient, and I need to write in the right ingredient. Or you know that you need to add a little bit more of an ingredient because we live at altitude, and so you write up something, a little note in the margin. Basically, that's what we're doing with our genes, is that we now have therapies, treatments that can go in and write those margins in, or that can take out that one ingredient and add the right ingredient in. And instead of, you know, making something that doesn't work, we're now making something that functions well and is healthy.
Well, you can hardly even contemplate what the opportunities might be. You mentioned, as I alluded to, SMA. What are some of the other things that maybe people are kind of, you know, just licking their chops over conquering finally and being able to give some hope where it was hopeless?
Yes. Well, cancer is a big one. So immunologic therapies for cancer is an enormous field and an exciting field where we can take cells out of the body. We can transform those cells. We can add more armor. We can add more things that detect cancer cells to make those cells stronger and more powerful. We put them back into the body to better detect and better attack cancer. So that's an area that's extremely exciting and is already well into treatment at the bedside. We also are now in the field of regenerative and stem cell therapies. So you're born with a weak heart, and we want to augment the strength of that heart. We can inject stem cells, which go in and promote growth. This is an emerging field. It's not at the bedside. It's in the research phases, but being able to affect things like heart disease is another area of opportunity that we're really excited about.
I'm so glad you mentioned stem cells. That was going to be my next question. There was so much hope for stem cells, you know, in the rearview mirror. I haven't heard a whole lot about it lately. Is it still an integral part then to what we're talking about here?
Yes, it certainly is. And we can derive those stem cells from normal cells now. So there's we're in an age where we can do it, you know, safely and effectively to find new treatments. And it's certainly a part of the center. It's a smaller part of the center. And a lot of that work is still filled with the possibility that we heard of, you know, a decade ago.
Does anybody ever kick around like and say, one of these days, like maybe fill in the blank, we'll just totally be able to shut off somebody's cancer? Is a day like that in the offing?
Well, I think we all certainly hope so. I think it's unfortunately more complicated than that, than perhaps the way we would think about it. I think we are in an age where we're developing more and more mechanisms and more treatments. Because every, you know, cancer is different. We have a different tool for every job. But that toolkit is growing tremendously rapidly. We're really at the beginning of much of this, which is what makes it so exciting for Primary Children's to be at the forefront of this work.
We've been talking with Dustin Lipson, who is the administrator for Intermountain Primary Children's Hospital. And what an amazing conversation. You wonder, and I won't be around for this, but you wonder by the year 2022 or, you know, 2021, what we're going to be like and what will be happening and what we'll look at in the rearview mirror the way now we look back on a lot of diseases that have practically been wiped out. I really appreciate your insights and your ability to explain this to even me. I think I grasp just a little bit of what you're talking about, and it's really exciting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Dustin Lipson with us, administrator for Intermountain Primary Children's Hospital. Can you imagine if we continue on this? Think of the things that have just changed in my lifetime since I was born. And you do wonder when the calendar, it's no longer 2019, it's maybe 2119. You wonder what in the world we'll be talking about when it comes to medical advancement at that point. Let's go ahead and take a brief break. When we come back, an earlier conversation here on KSL, it was our Boyd Matheson who talked with Representative Ben McAdams. We're going to follow up on that. We'll play some of the highlights from the conversation. But when it comes to protecting our children from inappropriate content in a digital app, what are some of the prosecutions that are underway right now? Sim Gill joins us next. In the few moments we have before we hit the top of the hour, and right after the top of the hour, we'll be talking with Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill. He'll be joining us. I sent a text to Sim, and our producers reached out to him as well, and I indicated that earlier we had talked with Ben McAdams, who is introducing a resolution to protect children from inappropriate content on digital apps. I was just chatting about this with our producer this afternoon, Amy, and boy, you think of what a different world it is. I mean, how many times have we had this conversation? The back in the day, you wanted to see something or get into or be part of something that was sketchy. It took some creativity. Now it's just hit the enter key. It is really amazing. And some of these things we think are fairly benign. But are they? And House Resolution 721 that Ben introduced along with Representative Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, just about 10 days ago, calls for the establishment of an app ratings board to enforce consistent and accurate age and content ratings of apps on Internet-ready devices. But rather than me just walk through everything that Ben had to say, this is our 4th District Congressman, of course, I thought it would be interesting to hijack some of the comments that he made earlier talking with Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources. And McAdams, of course, set the stage, talked about his own kids, the fact that he was a father. And some of these relatively innocuous apps have some really mature content.
The first hope would be to say government's not going to be able to regulate all content online. We probably shouldn't regulate all content online. We're going to put it to the industry to come up with some standards to help parents understand what type of content is on these apps, and really to police themselves. And if they don't do that, then there need to be consequences for allowing some of this really content that's preying upon our kids to be sanctioned. But hopefully the industry would respond favorably and recognize that this really is important for them to do, to take a leadership role in these apps and protecting, or at least being transparent about what type of content is in these apps, so that then families can protect themselves from content they don't want their kids to be exposed to.
Boy, sometimes it's amazing. You'll be going to something that you think is relatively benign or completely benign, and yes, that content is, but even down below, it's amazing the things that it can steer you to with just, again, a click. And often it's clickbait, obviously, so they'll say something either really outrageous or something really crazy or something really titillating. And, boy, all of a sudden, bam, you know, you never know where you can end up, and you wonder about what our kids are really seeing. Congressman McAdams talked about, again, this rating system.
This wouldn't be a government institution. It'd be like the motion picture one that's independent from government. But then they have real standards. Standards that can help me as a parent to have those filters that can protect my kids from some of the really harmful content. And, you know, there's apps out there that kids are using, like TikTok or even Instagram, that are pretty innocent in the hands of the right user, but really have some predatory and some content out there that can find our kids. And there's grooming that happens on these apps, and really, you know, they need to decide if they want to have some of that content on there, then they've got to give it a more mature rating.
What led me to calling Sim Gill was this part of the article that was related to what Ben McAdams and Louisiana Representative Mike Johnson want to accomplish. McAdams cited Salt Lake County arrest records to emphasize the danger of exploitive apps, saying Salt Lake police arrested 30 online predators, no, not in a month, not in, you know, a quarter, but in 4 days last month alone. Now, if 30 people were arrested as online predators in 4 days, imagine how many predators are out there and preying on our children. Ben McAdams also said that he wants the tech industry to buy into this as well.
I think we have to put some burden on the technology, the app developers in that, because one of the things that I know as a parent is, you know, there's technology where I can say that, you know, I don't want my kids accessing mature content. But there are other apps that say they're for kids ages 11 and up, and they have some really mature content on there. And I want to know, I want to put some of the onus of responsibility on the app developers to help us with this. And so,
we'll be talking with Sim Gill from Salt Lake County. He is our district attorney, and we'll get his take on this. And he handles, at least his office, handles some of these cases that we're talking about, these predators that are out there. And sometimes, boy, talk about wolves that are in sheep's clothing. So we'll get Sim's take on this as well. By the way, in our final hour of the program today, Alex Stone from ABC, again, this gets into this technology. We've heard about how Google, you know, kind of tracks this and that and has this information about us, and Facebook and back and forth. Well, how about your good old friendly local bank? Yeah, we're going to get into that as well. All here at KSL News Radio, where it's 2 o'clock now. Stay with us.
KSL FM. The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
We've been talking about some of the things that are just out there for our kids to click on. Back in the day, everybody, when I was a kid, they were just worried about, oh, these movies are going to, oh, the movies were so tame compared to what we have today. And then, wow, what about, you know, this and that? Back in the day, if you wanted to get into sketchy territory, it took some creativity and kind of stupid guts. Now it's just punch something into the phone that is in your backpack, in your pocket, in your purse, and just hit the enter key, and heaven only knows. And boy, if you're going for the sketchy stuff, it's out there. But sometimes, and what Representative McAdams is so concerned about, is the stuff that just is there on seemingly benign sites. And he, along with Representative Mike Johnson, who is a Republican from Louisiana, have called for, and this is just in the last week or so, the establishment of an app ratings board to enforce consistent and accurate age and content ratings of apps on the internet-ready devices. And you heard him mention that he doesn't want government involved. He wants this to be self-policing by the industry, by the tech companies, to basically put the ratings on these apps that are so readily available for our kids. And Ben McAdams said, and I'm quoting from an article here, as a parent to 4 kids, this issue really hits home for me. This resolution is common sense that parents, tech companies, law enforcement can all support. Nothing should get in the way of keeping our children safe from online exploitation. And as I've already alluded to, McAdams cited Salt Lake County arrest records to emphasize the danger of these exploitive apps, saying that the Salt Lake City Police, quote, arrested 30 online predators in 4 days last month alone in a crackdown on cybercrimes. I've turned to my friend Sim Gill, who is joining us right now, Salt Lake County District Attorney. And Sim, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you being here.
Always a pleasure to be here, Doug.
Boy, when I saw that number, you know, sometimes you go, wow, 30 online predators. And then it said, and I thought maybe in a month or maybe in a quarter. No, that was in 4 days. How big a deal is this, these cyber predators?
It's a huge deal. You know, our office, Doug, to give you a little bit of context, got involved almost a little bit over a year ago as a part of a task force. The good thing is it's a multi-agency, multi-jurisdictional task force, and the FBI came to our office and said, hey, we'd like you to participate in this. And we didn't have the resources, but the issue was compelling enough. We said, okay, we want to do that. So what we found is that as we started to participate on an ad hoc basis, that we had arrested almost 80 individuals on intermittently in a little bit less than a year. So then I said to our colleagues, I said, okay, I'd really like to get a better understanding on this. So let's do a 30-day window. And let's run some operations within a 30-day window with this task force. And so we decided we were going to run four operations. So even though we talk about a 30-day window, you're correct to identify there were actually 4 days out of those 30 days that we actually ran operations on. And in those 4 days of operations in that 30-day window, we netted another 30 online predators. And so for Salt Lake County, in a little bit over a year, we've got 110 active cases, predators that we arrested. And that, unfortunately, represents only a very small fraction. Because go back to that 30-day window that I'm talking about. If we had run operations every single day, that number would have been substantially different than the 30 that we got out of 4 days of operations.
Wow.
So that's the frightening number that we have. And then when you multiply that with that, for every person who is on there may have had contact with multiple other children prior to us catching them, and they may have been on multiple times, they're multiple individuals, then those mathematical permutations are something very alarming for us, and that's the alarm that we're trying to respond to.
These predators, when they are preying on their kids, what kind of, on our kids, what kind of dangers are children facing? What are these people doing?
So what they're doing is so we call this sort of online enticement. And this online enticement is a variation of all of the following and some that I probably won't even be able to articulate. For example, what they're doing is they're engaging in what we call grooming behavior. So they're actually befriending the child and they're interacting with them to build a relationship of trust, to put themselves in a position of exploitation. They're also there to actually engage in explicit sexual conversation as a part of that grooming behavior. They're exchanging photographs of themselves or getting the children to do it. And ultimately, they're engaging in physical contact, setting up a meet, so where the sexual exploitation of that child can occur. It is also linked to human trafficking of children and various other behavior. So it's a multiplicity of different kinds of behavior that they're engaging in different stages to ultimately the end result is to exploit the vulnerability of that child for a sexual purpose.
How many of these predators are local versus from out of state or even international?
You know, that's a great question. So one of the things to keep in mind is that our technology, you know, in the old days, as a parent, you know, my concern or your concern was, hey, our child gets done at school at 3 o'clock. They should be home by 3:20. And it was that moment that they left that school to physically get to our home. Now this technology compresses that distance because that distance is brought into our house. And we have what we've found from the different operations is certainly for Salt Lake County, we had people who were coming in from outside jurisdiction from other adjoining counties. We also had scenarios where individuals are traveling for business coming in and they may be staying in Salt Lake County and then they're engaging in online predatory behavior while they're visiting here. And it is not unheard of where we've had individuals who have made those contacts from being out of state and then showing up specifically in the state to engage in sexual contact and coming for that purpose. So it runs that full gambit of that that behavior of those individuals. And unfortunately, the distance that we have in geographical distance from state to state or coast to coast is no longer that distance on that digital device that's in your child's hands and in our homes.
Of course, Congressman McAdams is asking the industry and tech companies and so on to self-regulate and police themselves, not dissimilar from the Motion Picture Association that puts the PG or the whatever rating there might be on movies. Will that, in your opinion, Sim, will that make a difference?
Well, you know, I think every effort that we can engage in to protect our children is a worthy effort that we should be. You know, one of the reasons we had the press conference that was not only to put the predators on notice, but also to start a very important conversation with our parents and our community, that we need to start going back to fundamentals of that family, of that conversation with our children. And we need to really start finding out what apps are they on, what devices are they engaging in, what is good conversation, what is bad conversation, and ultimately talking to our children to say they're not to blame, they will not be, you know, we're not going to browbeat them or scold them, but we want open, honest conversations. So I think everything that we can do that will help arm that parent in whatever capacity, especially with the evolution of technology, I think is a good thing. I think the industry certainly needs to do more. We need to go back to the basics of speaking with our children and having that family time to build that trust. And then law enforcement needs to do its part. But we can't do it by ourselves. And that family community engagement is a critical part of it. And if that involves industry technology, I think that can't hurt us.
Well, I think of how much things have changed. You alluded to when I was raising my children, when you were raising your children, yeah. And just what a different world it is. I can remember not that long ago having the conversation with our attorney general. At that time, it was Mark Shurtleff here in the state. We were talking about some of these predators being online. And I remember asking him for his advice. He said, here's the thing you do. You take the family computer, and you look in your home and find the most trafficked area. Look down on the carpet, see where the wear is.
Yeah.
That's where you put the computer, so it is much more unlikely that somebody will be searching out sketchy sites. Boy, that wasn't that long ago, Sim, and now we all have that computer, including our children, in their backpack, in their hip pocket, or in their purse.
Absolutely.
And it's a different world.
It is, and therein lies the irony. We as parents invest in these technologies to keep our children safe. And ironically, it is these very same technologies and the mobility of these technologies that makes our children so vulnerable. And that's why the conversation with our family, as a family, with our children individually, becomes so critical. While this technology gives us a lot of freedom, it has also made us very alienated and isolated, and it also creates a very siloed existence, and we need to be able to break those silos down within our family structure.
Sim, I so appreciate you joining us on the show today. Thank you for your insights. I always appreciate what you and the people there in our county attorney's office do for us, and I wish you well, and I hope we have the chance to chat again soon, and have a great, happy holiday season.
Happy holidays to you as well, Doug.
Thank you. Sim Gill with us, our Salt Lake County attorney. All right, let's take a break. Wow, you know, it is just so daunting, really, when you think of it. Wow, to try to keep your kids from stumbling upon or seeking out some of these sites. What an obligation. When we come back, how our banks are data collecting. And we've heard about some of the things with Google and Facebook and so on. Well, our banks may be following suit. Alex Stone from ABC joins us next. Great to have you along on the program today here at KSL News Radio. And by the way, be sure to join me and the Movie Show Gang for a live broadcast at Ogden's Flooring. That'll be Friday from 9 to noon. Ogden's Flooring at 8912 South State Street. Visit ogdensflooring.com. We've been talking so much about the cyber universe. Today is Cyber Monday. After all of the things that are just kind of lurking out there for our kids, some of the wonderful opportunities, some of the really weird, sketchy things, and we've read all of the stories about some of these tech giants that are just collecting all kinds of strange stuff about you and about me. And now I was reading this. Banks are jumping on the data collecting bandwagon, and covering this on ABC News has been Alex Stone. Alex, thank you for joining us. And what kind of stuff is my bank gathering on me? There we go. Alex, we had to push the right buttons to get Alex on the line. Alex, tell us, what kind of things are the banks collecting on all of us now?
Well, hey, Doug, yeah, you know, it's one thing when you've looked at something online and then Facebook or Twitter, somebody else begins showing you ads of that thing that you've been looking at, or Amazon, that when next time you log in, they know you've been trying to search. But this goes beyond that. If you have credit cards with Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, a bunch of other banks that you may have noticed, some of them more recently, some within the last year or so, that they're beginning to offer you discounts at different places, that somewhere in the app you go into the credit card and you scroll down and you might get 10% off at Little Caesars or 10% at Macy's. And you may think that everybody's getting that, but no, that's being targeted toward you. That it turns out that they've now got third-party companies that these credit cards are working with that are doing the analytics based on where you're shopping. They infer what might entice you to go to somewhere else. That, let's say you go to Chipotle, maybe then you get the Little Caesars ad. You go to a clothing store, you get the Macy's ad. This has privacy advocates saying, well, wait a second, that your credit card activity has always been like going to the priest, that it has been locked up, that nobody's been able to analyze it, that what you're searching online is something totally different. But if they're able to analyze your buying habits, that could go far beyond just giving you offers at a fast food joint or at a pizza parlor, that it then could go on to be able to uncover more things about you. That's what they don't like.
Boy, Alex, I have to admit, I'm in that priest category you mentioned a moment ago. I thought that, you know, between my bank and between my doctor and between my clergyman, you know, it was kind of a sacred universe. And are banks making money on this?
Well, the companies, Chase being one of them, they say no, that they pretty much break even. They see it differently. They say that they're offering you something that they think that you want, that it's a convenience, that people have routinely shown that they would rather have a discount somewhere than protect their privacy, really, that if they give you 10% off to go buy something that you might want, that they're giving you a convenience, that they're giving you a discount, that people are looking for coupons and that they want to target those coupons. But again, going back to those privacy advocates, they say, you know, look, if somebody was having an affair, that your credit card company is probably going to know it first. What would they do with that data if they were able to down the line based on where you are and what you're buying? And even though your credit card company likely doesn't know the exact item that you're buying, if you're going into a liquor store, you're probably not going in there to buy peanuts. You're probably going in there to buy booze. And then they can infer something from that they can do a lot of the analytics and all this using these outside companies to figure out what you're buying, where, what you're likely to buy next, and that this is the very beginning of it right now, what they're beginning to do. But many of these groups are saying, whoa, there's a lot of potential here that the credit card companies could use with that data, and that scares some folks.
Well, you know, sometimes too, and I've heard my kids talk about it, and it's even affected me, you know, you're online and maybe you're buying something for Christmas or a birthday or an anniversary or whatever it is, and you're on kind of a communal device, maybe the family computer, or, you know, you don't mind passing your cell phone around, and all of a sudden, you know, something pops up and you've been looking at this nice gift for your spouse. You've been looking. I know my kids this year, they've made a big deal about it, and they're buying so much online, and it goes, hey, because you were looking at this, you need to take a look at this and this and this. And, you know, as you mentioned, there are sometimes coupons involved, and wow, you know, it can get a little totally innocent, sketchy.
Yeah, you know, even if you don't buy something, you just look at it and they show it to you again. I know my wife and I can't buy anything for each other on Amazon because it's going to show up on her phone and her then Facebook feed. Every ad will be whatever I was looking at,
right,
that she knows about it. And it can be a gift, or it could be something that, you know, maybe you were thinking of something else, or, you know, telling a joke with somebody and you look something up, but it's not necessarily something you're thinking about buying. But then your spouse wants to know why you're looking at that. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of aspects to this. Now, with the credit cards, you can, by law, opt out of all of this. But the issue, again, going back to those privacy advocates, is they say, how do you opt out of what you don't even know they're doing?
Yeah. I was going to ask you if there was an on-off switch here. So there is.
It is somewhere deep in that credit card agreement that they update every year and they send to you. But most of us aren't reading through that long credit card agreement, looking for every little line and knowing what this and that, what they title it and what they call it, knowing that you want to opt out of that. If you don't want to be part of this, you can call your credit card company, probably easier than trying to do it online, and let them know that this is not something that, you want to be a part of. But, again, it's where will this go, that as these privacy groups saying, you know, wait, and think about if they know that you're buying a lot of alcohol, and what if car insurance companies could tap into that data and talk about are they more likely to, drive drunk, or that you've used your credit card at a lot of hospitals, and then health insurance companies know that you've been to hospitals a lot. Right now, that's not possible, but the concern is among these groups, and whether or not it's a realistic concern is that one day outside companies could then buy that data and learn more about you. And by the way, right now, under the law, credit card companies say, well, look, it's all when it goes to that third party doing the analytics, yeah, it's you, but they don't know who you are. They're just giving you an offer based on your buying habits.
Yeah.
But there are also some ways that can be decrypted if somebody wanted to do that.
Well, we talk about third party and so on and things that are allegedly above board, but you wonder, you know, hackers and all kinds of potential here. Just a final quick question. I know you've got to run here, Alex, but are these just the big banks that are doing this, or would people be wise to check into their little local community banks as well?
Well, yeah, it's a lot of smaller banks as well. The big boys are doing it right now, and some of the smaller ones are too. Not everybody is. You know, I know from my credit cards that I thought it was kind of nice that I was getting these discounts until I learned this. You know, I thought everybody was getting a discount to fill-in-the-blank store, not knowing that it was based on what they have determined that I've been buying, that maybe the next thing that I would buy would be this, which, by the way, then they get ad money, essentially, from that company for driving you toward that store. And then if you use your credit card at that store, then they get a cut of that again because they're getting the profits off of that. But if you do see ads that seem targeted that are giving you offers to individual places, then they're probably crunching your data. American Express apparently does it in-house. Most of the rest go to the third-party companies. And it is something that, if it's going out of house to a third party, then you can opt out of it at that point if it makes you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't. A lot of people would say, wait, I want those discounts. If you can give me, you know, a couple of bucks off of a pizza, then I don't care if the computer is crunching those numbers and saying I'm probably going to go buy a pizza tonight.
Alex, I always enjoyed chatting with you. Thank you for joining us.
Great talking to you. Thanks, Doug.
Alex Stone, friend and associate at ABC here at KSL News Radio. You know, it still creeps me out. You know, I'll pull out of the parking lot here at KSL and it goes 17 minutes to get home. And I go, how does it know I'm going home? Maybe it's just a best guess, right? And then sometimes when I'll pull out of my street, it will tell me, you know, how long it will be until I arrive in Eureka. And I go, well, now, wait a minute. How does it know? If I turn right, maybe I'm going to KSL. It creeps me out. All right. So, you know, I'd be curious. Do you like that stuff? Do you like your bank to be kind of providing this service? Let's use the more politically correct or polite term from the banking point of view. No, this is a service, Doug. We just want to pass along a great discount to you or remind you of something else that you might be interested in if you already like this. I don't know. Okay, I'm curious. You can go to our Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line and let us know. Do you like the concept or not? Or like me, does it kind of creep you out? Hey, as I mentioned, the movie show is going to be at Ogden's Flooring, but we have all kinds of other things that are coming up on the movie show this Friday, so you don't want to miss that. And plus, you can join the movie show club, too, at 57500. We're coming up on 2:30. It's only fair to let you know we're going to follow. We're kind of in a cyber world today, which makes sense because it is Cyber Monday. You know, I have not purchased one thing on Cyber Monday. Does that make me un-American? I'm not quite sure. I'll probably have somebody knocking on my door tonight. Pete Ashdown will join us, the founder of X Mission. We're going to chat with him about some very issues in this arena, so stay with us.
more afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
I was reading an article. Obviously, I've been focused on cyber-oriented things lately. This was a guest opinion by Connor Boyack. It was in the Deseret News. And it said, your photo is being scanned by law enforcement over and over again every single day without your knowledge and consent, without your ability to opt out. Government, or should we say government officials, are scanning your face using software in hopes of matching you against a suspect. Now, we all see this in the movie. Gosh, what was I watching the other night? And it was, you know, one of those crazy things where they're tracking everybody on cams and everything else, doing facial recognition. It wasn't a John Wick's thing. What was it? Anyway, so we've all seen this. But then this was referred to in the very opinion piece that I am alluding to. The Washington Post reported that federal officials had been searching through driver's license photos in Utah and elsewhere. Remember a couple of years ago, we were all, you know, kind of foaming at the mouth over the fact that the NSA during the Olympics had gathered so much information on all of us? Well, apparently things like that are continuing. State officials who facilitated these requests have underscored that their federal partners don't have direct access. But still, there's no significant restrictions to the number of photos they're given or whether a warrant is required, and it's a free-for-all. Remember, we've talked about this, too, with facial recognition. We've talked about it with the cameras that are out there, that there is implied consent. If you're walking on the street, that's a public street, and there is implied consent that you are basically on camera. We know that. I mean, look at the gazillions of cameras we have on our streets and so on. Where does this begin and where does it end? And do we have any rights on this? And by the way, coming up this Thursday, we have U.S. Senators Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, and Senator Mike Lee of Utah will join the Brookings Institute Center for Technology Innovation for a bipartisan conversation about this very issue. But sometimes when I get really deep into the tech and this cyber world, I need to turn to minds immeasurably superior to mine, and that's why I called Pete Ashdown, the founder of X Mission, today. And Pete, thank you again for taking my phone call. One of these days you're going to go, can't this guy figure this out and just hang up?
But never, Doug. I'm always happy to help you sort these things out.
Well, let's talk about this. And first of all, talk to us about the technology. What is reality? What is just something maybe we see up on the movie screen? How is this used, and how good is facial technology?
It's getting much better than it was 10 years ago, and they've been making exponential improvements in it. However, every once in a while you hear a story about how clown makeup will fool this technology. There's people that sell ball caps that have faces on them that will fool the technology. So it's by no means perfect. Image recognition is very far away from being as good as a human. And even when you say as good as a human, my facial recognition technology isn't that good all the
yeah,
time.
I can relate.
Nothing is perfect in this area, but it's much better than it used to be. And it is getting concerning. I don't know if you had this experience, but about 6 months ago, I got on a flight with Delta and they said, well, we are allowing people in our database to get on with just a facial recognition scan. And I was like, I never took a picture for Delta. But sure enough, they allowed me to get on. And what I found out later is that they were using the passport photos.
Wow. Is that clear? You know, there's the lane for your TSA, whatever it is, and then there's the one that's clear. And I see people kind of shoving their face down on a screen. Is that what you're talking about?
The clear is different from what Delta was doing, which I think Delta dialed back because I haven't seen it recently. Clear, they do an iris scan on your eye and a fingerprint scan, and then tie that to your ID. So they have that information in there, but you have to give it to them. You have to subscribe to that service. It's a private commercial service that does that.
Wow.
TSA Pre just goes off of the indication on your boarding ticket that you are TSA pre.
I see. Pete, as far as the use of this, how common is the facial recognition? And in this opinion piece, it was said your photo is being scanned by law enforcement over and over again every single day. Is that accurate or is it hysterical?
I think it's a little bit on the line of hysterical. It's you know, there are surveillance cameras all over the town. We have them all over X Mission for our own uses, but we're not doing facial recognition. So whether you, I believe there is some use of it in the UK where they do have police cameras all over town, and the police do have cameras here, but I haven't heard of Salt Lake City PD doing any sort of facial recognition. That doesn't mean they're ruling it out. I mean, it would be a very useful thing for them to be able to catch suspects if they had an automated facial recognition going on. So I'd imagine if somebody came to them, either the federal government or a private entity, and said, hey, we can help you out with this, they'd probably look at that seriously. But as far as my knowledge, it hasn't happened yet in Utah. Whether it's happened in other states, I think it probably has. So it's a growing concern. It's not saturated yet to the point where we need to be paranoid.
Some of this seems so Big Brotherish, and maybe that's just something for baby boomers, because I don't see these concerns or even fears with millennials or Gen Xers or, you know, fill in the blank. But I do see it with baby boomers. Is it because we grew up, you know, fearing that dystopian environment, the 1984 syndrome, as it were, Fahrenheit 451?
Well, I'm solidly in Gen X, and I know that many of my peers are concerned about their privacy. I think the digital natives have grown up with this, and they don't know anything different. That's not to say that there isn't a lot of concern coming from the younger generations about individual privacy. I think they need to be made aware of it, that this is not the normal. This is you know, thumb scanning and facial scanning and sharing that information and what companies like Facebook and Google are doing with private information is not the normal, because that's what they've grown up with.
Yeah. As far as warrants and so on, can this mesh every time police or government or whatever it might be need facial recognition? Should they have to have a warrant?
I think it should always err on the side of individual privacy, and that's what I've fought for with my company and technology, that we consider all of our customer data papers and effects. And I would argue that your face is your effect, and it should also be protected by the Fourth Amendment. We need to see some court cases come through to make sure that the courts affirm this. But again, I believe in the broadest interpretation of the Fourth Amendment in favor of individual privacy. What concerns me is the Delta situation, where we have the government is sharing passport photos with the airline for a purpose that they didn't intend. Now, obviously, we need to be able to verify people getting on and off planes, but plugging it into a facial recognition database is a little bit beyond that, in my opinion.
Just prior to chatting with you, we had Alex Stone from ABC, and he was reporting on this Cyber Monday that now it's not just Google, it's not just Facebook, it's not some of the other, you know, huge names in the tech world that we think of, but it's now your friendly local bank that is gathering all kinds of data, and it is being made available to third parties who then suggest, hey, you were just here. Wouldn't you like to go here? And here's a $10, you know, coupon, or here's a 10% off coupon. You know, it's getting to the point where you go, can I do anything and have any privacy? I drive out of the parking lot here at KSL. It goes, oh, you're 18 minutes from home, Doug. And
yeah, and that data is collected and stored.
Yeah.
And I think we need our legislators, our representatives, to push back against this and say, you know, these user agreements that they throw out in front of you that are page after page of legalese that nobody reads is not good enough to protect individual privacy. We need to take a stand and by default protect individual privacy. And if people want to share their faces to databases and their browsing habits to databases, they should be asked that question before it is done. Because right now, a lot of tech companies just assume that it's okay to do if the customer doesn't know what's happening.
If you were going to be participating, you ran for U.S. Senate at one time, and U.S. Senators Chris Coons and also Senator Mike Lee of Utah joined the Brookings Institute Center for Technology Innovation for a, quote, bipartisan conversation about facial recognition technology. What would be some of the things that you would want to have addressed there, Pete?
Not only facial recognition, but our habits, our demographics, our usage online, and even when we don't know we're online, when we're using things like maps and browsing on our phone, we may not actually realize that that information is being collected. Again, going out for a broad protection of individual privacy, facial recognition, thumb scanning, any sort of biometrics, as well as our habits that are collected by tech companies, and protecting those from being shared and abused would be the first step, in my opinion.
You know, it's interesting because sometimes even in just preparing for the show, several times with several different producers over the years, we've looked at each other and go, oh, man, if anybody was collecting this data and looking what we're, you know, searching for this morning, and it's all show-related, you know, it gives an interesting, not accurate picture of an individual. And I really get concerned about this, you know, how much of this stuff is gathered, and it could be something, and Alex and I were talking about this too, just something as simple as buying a gift at Christmas time or during the holiday season for your spouse, and all of a sudden your phone, the home computer's popping up, all kind, the iPad that you have sitting there by the television, and it's, hey, you were just searching for this, how about looking at that? And it's a gift that you've been thinking about. It creeps me out.
You're right, Doug, and all too often it's a shoot first and ask questions later attitude. When you get somebody saying, well, they were searching for this topic, and not getting the full story about why they were searching for that topic, it can absolutely disrupt somebody's life for law enforcement or somebody else to come in with that information and make assumptions.
Yeah, it's kind of like, hey, let me tell you the rest of the story on that. Pete, I always appreciate your insights. Thank you for taking the call. I hope you have a great holiday season, and I hope you don't mind if we call you again occasionally.
You too, Doug. Be safe.
Pete Ashdown with us, the founder of X Mission, and often on these technical cyber issues, I need to turn to, as I often say, the minds immeasurably superior to mine in this arena. And boy, I always appreciate Pete joining us. All right, let's take a brief break. And when we come back, I'll share some of the texts that have come in. We'll look back on some of the things we've talked about today. So stay with us. A lot more coming up in just the final few moments that we have here at KSL News Radio. Hey, thank you so much for being part of the program today. We've been all over the place talking about things. I appreciated the conversation with BYU Professor Spencer James. We talked about the effects that we see in society and what has kind of brought us to the point where so many births in the United States of America are now, the term would have been, out of wedlock. And boy, here in Utah, you know, we're right at the bottom, and a lot of people say, well, that makes sense. And the fact that Idaho is kind of in that same league with us, they say, well, you know, that makes sense too. You know, they're rather conservative, pardon me, states, and also there's a dominant influence of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But right in between Utah and Idaho is Colorado. And Colorado is kind of an interesting animal because on one level, they are in the lower participants in religion in the entire country. But something else that we talked about with the professor was the fact that money does matter and social status matters. And so that could be one of the reasons that Colorado is kind of in the same league with us when it comes to births outside of marriage. Another topic that we got into, pardon me, I got a little frog in my throat here. I obviously need more Diet Coke. Cheers. Can I do this while I'm on the air? everybody knows my my acclaimed weakness here. Man, and I'm almost out, so it's a good thing the show's going to end here in a couple of minutes. Talking with the Salvation Army is always a real joy, and Captain Rob Lawler joined us from the Salt Lake City area. And there are all kinds of different opportunities now to give, including apps right there on your phone. You can give money that way. We've had an ongoing conversation about the special session of the legislature that people are anticipating, at least the rumblings I'm hearing, are going to be on December 12th. And boy, there's some big issues. The sales tax issue, changing that structure that for services that we've talked about. But boy, education is really kind of moving to the front burner right now. And we're going to reach out to some leadership in the legislature. Hopefully we'll be able to talk with either the president of the Senate and maybe the minority leader in the Senate. I know last week Dave and Debbie had the chance to talk with Representative Brad Wilson, who is the Speaker of the House. Brian King, of course, is the minority leader. So we'll try to get a little preview of what is anticipated for that special session. And boy, education is, as I mentioned, the big topic last year was, well, you know, services, sales tax on services, and now it looks like education is moving to the forefront. And also, Pete Ashdown, I can't thank Pete enough for joining us, the founder of X Mission, to talk about some of the technology that is out there. There are a few things, too, that I wanted to mention just quickly before we hit the end of the program. And one, of course, is Quarters for Christmas. Quarters for Christmas has been such an important part of KSL during my entire duration and even beyond. I've mentioned this before, that when I was just dying to get into radio, I can remember having a great relationship with several people who mentored me, and one was Bob Simmons. And I can remember visiting Bob at KSL back in the old days when we were over on Social Hall Avenue. And I remember for some reason he was telling me about Quarters for Christmas and just what a great program it was and what great things that it did. And it was relatively new at that time in the mid to late 60s. I know, can you believe that long ago? And I can remember I really caught the spirit of it. I've told this story a gazillion times. If you've heard it before, I apologize. But the very first check I ever wrote as a kid, I just opened a checking account at Valley Bank there on Highland Drive, and I wrote out a whole $1 check to Quarters for Christmas back then. I've said this before, that I wish that I'd saved that check. I really do. I have. It's, you know, long gone, certainly. But that's what Quarters for Christmas is all about, and that's what Bob explained to me at that time, that it's not about big donations, although if you want to give a big donation, that's wonderful and always appreciated. But the quarters for Christmas, the dollar bills, the small donations. And imagine if everybody, with our 3 million plus people now in the state of Utah, if everybody just gave 50 cents, if everybody gave a buck, can you imagine? The dollars be amazing. KSL Quarters for Christmas time, by the way, is $2.59 right now. And a quick reminder that you can take us wherever you go. Listen live and on demand. Download the KSL News Radio app. It's powered by our friends at Any Hour Services. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about some of the avalanche dangers that are here in the state of Utah because of some of the great snowfall we've had. That and more coming up. I'll see you tomorrow at 12:30. And Jeff Kaplan is coming up next right here at KSL News Radio.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.